The following message will cover UN Agenda number 21, and is given by Michael Kaufman.
Here, because Michael Kaufman, Ph.D., Dr. Michael Kaufman's a fascinating man. He received his B.S. in forestry and his M.S. in biology at Northern Arizona University at Flagstaff. He got his Ph.D. in forest science at the University of Ohio, or University of Idaho at Moscow, and since that time, he's been involved in ecosystem research, and that's been for a period of almost 20 years. He's actually had jobs in private industry. He's testified widely. He's written widely. And of course, he's currently the president of Environmental Perspectives Incorporated, wherein he provides professional guidance and training in defining environmental problems and conflicts and developing solutions to specific issues. Now, he played a key role in stopping the ratification of the Convention on Biological Diversity, that is the Biodiversity Treaty, when it was presented to the United States Senate by anticipating and exposing the unbelievable agenda behind that treaty. He's been a featured guest on the Outdoor Channel and numerous national radio shows, Point of View, G. Gordon Liddy, and others. He's recently written two books exposing the environmental phenomenon, Saviors of the Earth, The Politics and Religion of Environmentalism, and The Dawn of Aquarius, or The Twilight of a New Dark Age. In addition to his secular profession, Dr. Kaufman is active in the Nazarene Church, where he's a board member, chairman of the Christian Education Committee, and teaches in-depth Sunday school classes for adults. In the latter effort, he spent 1995 doing extensive research and writing for his class on Bible prophecy as it relates to current events. And so I think that we'll certainly be totally in sympathy with Dr. Kaufman and his views. Dr. Kaufman, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for being with us this evening. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about you? I've already read most of your bio. Are you currently in academia, or are you spending full time with your organization, the Environmental Perspectives Incorporated?
Well, I am still an adjunct professor at the University of Maine, but I do very little in that anymore. Primarily involved in my business and ministry and trying to help people understand that the environmental movement is not, or at least the environmental leadership, let me put it that way, is not necessarily being open and candid with the American people, and in fact, is misleading us in many, many very serious ways.
And, of course, you understand the Biodiversity Treaty. I don't think that the average person out there has any idea what this is all about. Could you go into some detail on what the Biodiversity Treaty was? Was that the treaty that came out of the Rio conference?
Yes, it was. Back in 1992, if the listeners will recall, there was the Rio conference, the Earth Summit, that President Bush refused to go to, but was finally caterwauled, if you want to put it that way, and pushed into going. And one of the things that came out of that he refused to sign was the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is a treaty that was designed to theoretically protect biodiversity both in the United States and around the world. Now, this sounds like a very innocuous motherhood and apple pie kind of concept. I had been following it for a number of years. In fact, it's been in the building stages since the early 1980s. But it only was about 18 pages of 8.5 by 11 paper, and literally just was a series of motherhood and apple pie statements, except where it came from to the real teeth. And for the very first time, the United States was being asked to sign a treaty that had some real teeth to it. We've signed a couple agreements since then that have had real teeth, but this one really was the first one that had some really substantial teeth that could allow the United Nations or the World Court to force the United States to comply with whatever it deemed was necessary to preserve biodiversity, and that was not spelled out anywhere in the treaty.
In other words, we were signing an agreement, and we didn't know the implications of what
that's
we were
exactly
really
right. We were going to sign a treaty, eventually ratify it theoretically. It had a lot of teeth to it, but did not say what we had to do. Going to come afterwards.
It's sort of like you buy a car and you say, well, how much is it going to cost? And they say, well, you know, it's going to cost you $300 a month. You say, how long? They said, just $300 a month. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, right. We'll settle that afterwards.
Well, now, apparently, This treaty then, when Bill Clinton came in, Bill Clinton signed it and sent it to the Senate to get it ratified, and it looked like it was going to go right through, didn't it?
Yes, it did. In fact, it went to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and resided there for about a year, but that's really no real surprise to anyone. Those things kind of languish. And it came out from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with a recommendation to ratify, with only two abstentions, one of them being Jesse Helms from North Carolina.
Why didn't he vote against it?
He did vote against it.
Oh, he did, okay.
Yes, and he was one of the only two that did. I can't remember who the other senator was. He convinced a half a dozen other senators within the first few days after it came out on the floor that they needed to oppose it. But it wasn't until we launched a real serious fax alert, which probably reached about 15,000 people overnight on August, I believe it was the 3rd or the 4th of 1994, that the Senate literally got inundated with phone calls from around the country. And the Senate Foreign Policy Committee told us that for that type of thing to happen, we had to reach between 1 and 4 million people within 24 hours. I was stunned to realize that their response was that great when, as you indicated earlier, very, very few people even knew this treaty existed, let alone was coming up for ratification.
Okay, now, what were some of the implications that you could see in the biodiversity treaty had we actually gone ahead and signed it? Was this part of this movement to basically take half the land and give it back to the wolves?
That's what we had suspected, and we didn't have a smoking gun, and that was the serious nature of not having the implementing language with this treaty when the Senate was trying to vote on it. We weren't sure. Article 8 said that there were to be areas that would be set aside as protected areas and interconnected and so forth, but that could mean a number of different things, and as a consequence, we knew that the same people who wrote what is known as the Wildlands Project also had a hand in writing the treaty itself. So we suspected that very strongly that it was one and the same. And we had told the U.S. Senate that numerous times, as we had tried to do, to get a hold of a document called the Global Biodiversity Assessment that was in the draft stages in support of the treaty, and the implementing language was to come out of this, what is known as the United Nations Global Biodiversity Assessment. And that should spell it out very clearly. And the interesting thing was that the United Nations, now this just didn't happen once, it happened to many, many different people and to the U.S. Senate several times during the summer of 1994. The United Nations told our U.S. Senate that this document didn't exist and there was no intention of ever writing such a document. And we knew it existed because the money had been allocated, the writers had been found and were in process of writing this. We knew it existed in draft form somewhere. And as a consequence, we made a major effort then in the latter part, after we got it postponed in August, what had happened then with the fax alert that was sent out with the inundation in the Senate decided it was going to delay the vote for a month or indefinitely, but it turned out to be a month. And as a consequence, it gave us some breathing room, and we really started to shake the bushes for this document. We finally got a copy of it on September 29th, 1994. This is the day before the cloture vote was to be taken on this treaty. This is how close we came, folks. We got this document. It's over 3,000 pages long. And in it, and very boldly, it says that the protection of biodiversity will be based upon what is known as the Wildlands Project. Now, very few of you probably heard of this particular entity, but it's been developed by some of the most radical so-called conservation biologists in this nation. And in that document that was cited by the United Nations, it calls for setting aside up to 50% of the American landscape into wilderness areas and interconnecting corridors, all surrounded by human buffer zones in which you would have extreme regulation, severely limiting what kind of agriculture, forestry, and other world types of land use could be permitted.
In other words, people would be forced off of the land, and they would be forced into those habitat areas that the government wanted them, and the total loss of property rights for those people who lived, in the wilderness, or what were to be taken as the wilderness regions.
That's the tragic part of it. And the other side of that whole issue of property rights it spells out on this document very, very clearly that what they plan is to replace property rights with what is known as usufructuary rights.
And, of course, that is the total destruction of our constitutional system of individual liberty. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Professor Michael Kaufman here talking on the Biodiversity Treaty. Radio Liberty, our guest this evening is Dr. Michael Kaufman, and, of course, he's written a book. What is the title of your book?
The name of the book is called Saviors of the Earth, The Power and the Politics of Modern Environmentalism.
And, of course, you've written another book that sounds very much like you're in tune with much of our thought, something about the New Dark Ages.
Yes. My first book is called Environmentalism, The Dawn of Aquarius or The Twilight of a New Dark Age.
And, of course, that The Dawn of Aquarius deals with the idea of the Aquarian movement, the New Age movement taking us into this wonderful utopia that they plan.
Oh, yes. And, unfortunately, it's very real. It's coming down very, very rapidly now, both from the United Nations and from, and tragically from our own federal government. And, you'd be shocked to realize how much of the old paganism, that's so much a part of the New Age movement is now as taught as fact and so forth within our school systems and has totally distorted both history and current understanding of current events.
Now, is that covered in your book about the New Dark Ages?
Yes, it is, very much so, and quite in depth, as a matter of fact.
Okay, fine, because I think that's so important. You know, Doctor, the thing that disturbs me is most Christian leaders have no glimpse of how this really applies. All these ideas of dark and demonic and satanic forces is something more or less theoretical, but they don't understand how it's being played out on the political battlefield, on the environmental battlefield, on our educational battlefield, in our courts. It totally surrounds us today. Christianity and the Judeo-Christian concepts are under attack, and people sort of shrug and say, well, gee, you know, boy, we're having a great time watching the Olympics. And nothing wrong with the Olympics. I've enjoyed watching them, too. But, you know, America is at war. Our society is at war. We're under attack, and most people don't even know the war is going on.
That is so true and so tragic. Just as an example, over $5 million has been donated by various foundations, including the Rockefeller Foundation, to promote material, develop material that has been sent out in over 53,000 churches, promoting the idea that the saving the environment ought to become the central thesis of what is preached and taught in the Sunday schools and so forth of these various churches around the country, and literally reaching millions of Christians, including their pastors and ministers and so forth, that have no idea that this is nothing more than an attempt, as in Romans 1:25, to begin the process of worshiping the created rather than the creator.
Amen to that. Well, of course, what better place to work to undermine Christianity than in the churches themselves?
Absolutely.
And they're doing such a magnificent job of it. And a lot of our well-meaning ministers, they love the Lord, but they really don't understand what we're up against.
No, they really don't, because most of them, and in many cases, I can understand why, because in most cases, the only thing they understand is what they get in the mail and what they read in the newspapers. And that is about as far off the mark as you can possibly get as to what the real environmental movement is truly all about. And let me just give you a current example of how they do this. You're going to be hearing over the next several weeks a lot. In fact, you've already heard in some cases in some of your daily newspapers and so forth how all the scientists now have a strong consensus that we have not only global warming and global climate change, but it's caused by us. And as a consequence, we have to launch major programs. You're talking about trillions of dollars worth of programs that will break this nation to solve this problem. When in fact, when the scientists wrote this report last fall, they had 17 pages of very carefully worded understanding of where the science is on global warming and global climate change, and basically they have said that we do not really know what is causing global change, whether it's natural, whether it's say artificial, whether man is involved or anything else. There is change going on. Nobody denies that, but there's always been change going on. And as a consequence, they very carefully worded this. And the United Nations, what's known as the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, the executive director of that went in and changed those 17 pages and deleted every single reference to the fact that they do not know if man is causing these particular problems.
And, of course, we've seen a couple of articles by Dr. Fred Singer in the Washington Times, the New York, pardon me, the Wall Street Journal. And then, of course, we see the people from the IPCC, the International Panel for Climate Change, is that right, IPCC, writing in and saying, why, we didn't change. I mean, how can you say we changed anything? And you read these articles and you say, where is the truth, there's all this denial, These men wouldn't write into the Wall Street Journal and frankly lie about taking all those 17 pages out. And, of course, they really are lying, aren't they?
They are very, very much lying. In fact, I had a colleague at the meeting in Geneva the last 2 weeks, and he had indicated very strongly, in fact, he asked a question point blank, because he was there with press credentials, about the concern that the scientists' comments were deleted. And the executive director basically said, well, consensus means many things, and I'm paraphrasing now because I don't remember the exact quote, consensus can mean many things, but we will interpret it the way we want to.
Now that must be Mr. Henry Lamb, because he's the only person I know who had press credentials, and we actually did an interview with Mr. Lamb from Geneva last week, and we've played that several times here on Radio Liberty.
Excellent.
Fascinating material, and so vitally important that we get out to people. I'm beginning to, find out who the people are then that I can depend on for information, because I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon, and so I have to depend upon you experts in the field to keep us appraised of what's going on. And certainly we've had Fred Singer on our program, and he's verified the fact that he designed the equipment that's used to measure global warming, and yet when he says that there really is no significant global warming, I believe that he is certainly an authority on this, and I know both you and Henry Lamb are as well. And yet these people have the audacity, and the Wall Street Journal has the effrontery to publish these denials, and then usually the person with the last word is the one whose ideas seem to stay with the public.
Yes, unfortunately, that is correct. I sometimes wonder if it's by design, but I have talked to some of the international and national environmental journalists, and for the most part, there are people out there, there are reporters out there that have an axe to grind, and they're an activist reporter, and you're just going to have to deal with those. But many, unfortunately, are basically intellectually honest individuals, but they just are totally and absolutely deceived. Partly because they cannot see. They've got tremendous blind spots because of the education that they've had, and do not understand the issues at all because they have never been taught to understand the issues from other perspectives than what the political correct dogma might be.
But
it is unfortunate because, ladies and gentlemen, most of what you hear coming out of the environmental leadership is dead wrong, and in many cases is an outright lie. Unfortunately, many people working within the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society and so forth are doing it for very good, honest reasons, personal reasons, where they want to protect the clean air and clean water, just like you and I do. But on the other hand, what they don't see, because they're so close to the problem and will not listen to anybody else but their own people, is the fact that their leadership is lying to them, literally lying to them. And I do speeches all across the country. And I've had environmental people who have actually worked on things like the Convention on Biological Diversity in my audience that literally go into a state of shock as the larger picture is opened up to them and they can see what they're doing and how it's going to end with a futile totalitarian type of government that is just going to crush this country if we don't get it stopped.
And, of course, as you look at this, you recognize there is an agenda that seems to be aimed at taking us into a totally controlled society.
Oh, absolutely. And I was just before the break mentioning the fact, for instance, with property rights. And property is very fundamental, I think, as many of the listeners understand, to all of our other liberties. And in property rights, they say that property rights are not, they're changeable. there are a dynamic relationship between two individuals or two groups, and that we are to replace property rights with what they call usufructual rights. Well, and listen to this very carefully. Usufructual rights was a concept developed by the Caesar during the Roman Empire, days of the Roman Empire, in which all land belonged to Caesar. And he allocated out certain rights to his local governors, who in turn allocated those out to the farmers and ranchers and so forth of the day. They're nothing but a permit system, and it can be revoked at any time. Now, think about this. Many of you have had sexual discrimination or discrimination of some sort or another when you're in the workplace. Some of you might even quit your job and gone to work someplace else because of that kind of discrimination and other things that are going on in the workplace. But imagine this. You have to have property. Now, property can take many different forms, but you have to have property either to grow your crops or to conduct business, and certainly you need it to build a home for you, to house your family. Without those three things, you have no place to go and nothing to eat. Property rights controls the society, period. There is no exception, because the First Amendment right of free speech, for instance, is worthless if whom you would speak out against has the ability to take you off your land or away, your business away from you or whatever the case might be. You are not going to speak out against that individual if you have a family to try to protect.
And, of course, the word property is never found in the Constitution unless you also find the words life and liberty. And
yes.
Life, liberty, and property were the trilogy, the foundation, the three legs upon which individual liberty rested. So the idea of doing away with property rights, you know, is really so frightening. And yet what really bothers me, Doctor, is, you know, when we talk about forfeiture, and people say, well, you know, well, you take it away from the drug dealers, and then, of course, you maybe take it away from other criminals, and but they don't understand that if you can take their property away, they can take your property away, too. When forfeiture becomes a means of taking people's property away because you suspect that they've done something wrong without a criminal trial, I mean, they can always take it away after a criminal trial. But, you see, this goes back to the laws of piracy under the British Crown, and those laws are being invoked here in America without any basis in American law.
In fact, no constitutional basis.
Right.
To me, the Constitution says just the opposite. Of course, the Constitution says just the opposite on a number of issues than what we're doing right now. But you're absolutely right. In fact, the Revolutionary War wasn't fought over tea in Boston Harbor. It was basically fought over property rights,
right,
just as you were inferring. The right of seizure, as the king was doing, is something that our founding fathers recognized was very fundamental to their freedoms and the ability for them to prosper.
And, of course, unless we can get people to understand our history, to understand our Constitution, to understand what freedom is all about, we have no chance of turning this whole thing around. Well, do you see us moving rapidly towards a world government?
In fact, I think, unfortunately, it's liable to happen very, very quickly. When it does happen, it's going to happen so fast that it's going to make your head spin. And I sense that we're probably within three. I think they would like to have it in place by the year 2000. Everything indicates it in the literature that I come across. In fact, we're starting, people like myself and yourself are starting to make inroads in helping the American people understand the threat, and the number of people that are beginning to understand this is approaching critical mass. And once that happens, it's going to take off, and it really doesn't matter if the media tries to stifle it or not. It's going to happen. The fact that we were able to get up to 4 million people in 24 hours to start calling the U.S. Senate is just nothing short of a miracle. And one of these days it's going to happen, and they know that, and they need to get the infrastructure for turning power over to the United Nations or whatever global governing authority winds up with this power as quickly as they can.
I have to interrupt you there. To Dr. Standback here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening is Dr. Michael Kaufman. His book, Saviors of the Earth? Now, Dr. Kaufman, how can people get copies of your first and second books?
They can call us at 1-800-799-9878.
1-800-799-9878, and we'll give that number out several times. Is Have you been able to get this out to regular channels?
Yes, to a degree. One of the things that I have found very advantageous is that I do a lot of speaking across the country. And once I have spoken in an area, generally the book sales in that particular area will start to spread and actually get into the secular community. It's published by Moody Press under the title Northfield Publishing to be a crossover into the secular world. And it's having a major impact. I have had feedback, for instance, from the key environmental leadership that they're deathly afraid of it.
Well, I hope that they lose a little sleep over it.
Because I hope so, too.
Because the thing is that with the degree of control that exists over the media, they have hammered away at this lie of the ozone hole and the global warming and the acid rain and all of these things are frightening the people to death about things that have little scientific validity, but repeated often enough, people have come to believe that we're just going to destroy the Earth, and the only solution is more power to the government. Now, our telephone number here, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you're out there in the listening audience and have a question or comment for Dr. Kaufman. Are you acquainted at all with something called Agenda 21?
Yes, I am. In fact, that's what started to really make me concerned about, or one of the things, I should say, about where this whole movement was truly heading.
Well, could you go into that? Because they're beginning to implement that in our community.
Absolutely. In fact, we just about 3 or 4 weeks ago in Istanbul, Turkey, had Habitat 2, which was, so far in America, most of the suffering as a result of Agenda 21 and the federal government implementing policy. Now, this is right within EPA guidelines and all the rest, that we must begin to adjust internal national policy to meet international expectations and policy, including the Convention on Biological Diversity and Agenda 21. That's not quite an exact quote, but it's pretty close.
Even though we didn't sign the Treaty on Biological Diversity.
That's ironic. In fact, I get calls all the time where the Fish and Wildlife Service and others have tried to use the Convention on Biological Diversity as a justification for the reintroduction of wolves or grizzly bears or you name it into an area. And the general population, especially in rural America, is starting to become aware of it now that this treaty was never ratified, and they challenge them. And I think it's great to be able to have an enlightened citizenry sufficient to challenge the government bureaucrats when they try to jam something down a local community's throat, which is totally fallacious.
But, the tragedy is that many of the people, and I'm not saying all of them, but many of the people who've gone into the Forest Service and gone into these government jobs really are authoritarianists. They're people who want power, and they utilize that power whether it's justified or not.
That is very true, and interestingly enough, there has been a number of studies in the psychological field, whether you believe in psychology or not, but I truly believe this because I think it's basic human nature. It's fundamental natural law. And that is that people, just like you and I, now I'm not saying that you and I and the listening audience would necessarily do that, because I think as Christians we have an accountability to a higher authority that might stop us from doing that. At least I hope so. But nonetheless, a typical average American is capable of executing unbelievable horrors on their fellow man if only two conditions are met. One is it's a higher goal. In other words, they really believe that what they have to do is necessary because of whatever it is. In this case, it's saving the environment. And two, you have a permission from a higher authority.
Well, it's just what you do and more. You're told it's all right to kill those people because they're your enemy. You have the permission from a higher authority. And this is what's so terrible about war, because we turn normal, healthy people, idealistic people, into murderers.
That's very, very true, and of course it leaves tremendous damage to people who have to go through those wars, and I hope we never fight another one, but the way we're heading, I'm just not sure what's going to happen. It's very, very tenuous. If they get what they want with the Convention on Global Warming and a variety of other things, I can expect our economy to begin to collapse, and once that begins to happen, then we're going to start seeing factionalism and one group pitted off against another, both within the United States and of course between nations, and it could just, I just cringe when I think of it. Other than the fact that we knew who ultimately is in control.
Amen. Well, we at least have an idea how it's going to end, but I think it may be a stormy course for a good many years.
I'm afraid you're right.
Okay, fine. Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us about Agenda 21? Because I know some of my listeners were asking me today, have you ever heard of Agenda 21? And I said, well, we're going to talk about that this evening. So why don't you tell us what it's all about?
Well, Agenda 21 is a series of principles. It's called what is known as soft law. It has no teeth to it, but it establishes a series of principles in which all nations have committed themselves to begin to focus policy, their internal policy to meet. And it's a series of statements and policy concepts in which we will begin to do a number of things. We will begin to clean up our environment, to reduce such things as global warming and acid rain and ozone depletion, all those types of things. We will have a consciousness of biocentric, what is known as biocentric, bio meaning life, centric meaning centered, a biocentric awareness of the life around us so that we can begin to harmonize with nature. I mean, these are words that are actually used in the document. I mean, they may not be used in exactly the way I'm saying them, but pretty close. And as a consequence, and to achieve what is known as sustainable development. Sustainable development is a large part of Agenda 21. And what we do not realize is that in April of this past year, our president released a report developed by the President's Council on Sustainable Development for the United States that literally step by step, if he gets what he wants, will implement Agenda 21, will meet the provisions of the Convention on Biological Diversity, even if we don't sign the treaty or ratify the treaty, and meet the conditions of global warming and carbon dioxide reductions and the CFC reductions and so forth. All of these things that are pointed out in Agenda 21 as being necessary goals, this soft law, it doesn't have any teeth, but these are goals in which we shall start to focus our national policy, are wrapped up in the President's Council on Sustainable Development's report, and he is busily issuing executive orders that will, I think, if he is in for a second term, gradually be implemented even without congressional authority.
And, of course, then what you're suggesting is that we really don't have representative government. We have a government by decree, and that government will lead to this total control over every aspect of life, with loss of property rights. And of course, when we talk about these various problems, we're talking about ever-increasing government control and regulation. When you talk about implementing the climate change specifications, you're talking about cutting down energy production and consumption here in America, what, 50 to 60%?
That's what I've had the feeling. I've never seen an actual number, but I get a sense in reading their literature that they're looking for an actual reduction in our gross national product by up to 50 to 60%.
Now, it's gross national product or energy consumption or both?
Well, what they're talking about for goals that just came out of Geneva last week and which we signed and agreed to was that we would, within 10 years, reduce our amount of CO2 emissions to 20% less than the 1990 levels, which means about a reduction of 30%. Eventually, over the next 50 years or so, and I don't know this number for sure, but it's a longer time period, we would reduce our CO2 emissions by 50% over 1990 levels, which, if we had alternative energy sources, that would be fine. But we do not, at least not in that kind of a time frame. And as a consequence, the only way that we can reduce it is to stop using your automobiles, stop using trucks and so forth to transport different things, stop using all kinds of things, even electrical appliances, because so many of our power plants are coal-fired power plants, which in turn emit CO2 into the atmosphere. So air conditioning and things like that. Air conditioning is the biggest target for anybody that's living in the South right now. This ought to be bad news, because air conditioning is the number one target that they have for elimination or at least reduction.
And of course, you know, what's really so incredible about this, it really means a deindustrializing our society. When we had the opportunity to put in nuclear plants, they're putting nuclear plants into China now in large numbers, but we can't have nuclear plants in America because, of course, nuclear results in contamination. But they're not worried about it in other countries. It's just America that is under attack. Let's go to Mike here. Hi, Mike. You have a question or comment?
Well, a couple of things. One comment and one question.
Okay, fine.
First, a comment in the interest of an informed public. I'd like to put in that Agenda 21 and five other significant Rio de Janeiro documents are available on the internet. If you search the UN.
Do you have that? How can we get them on the internet?
Well, I'm about to tell you.
Okay, fine.
If you search the UN, all you have to do is key in Earth Council, and that'll take you to the Rio Summit homepage.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the lower part of the homepage and just poke around a little bit. You'll find it there's a section on documents. You can find it in English, French, and Spanish. So naturally go to English, and you can find these six documents in particular. One is Agenda 21. If you want to download it, I'd suggest go to disk rather than try and print it, because it'll print to 450 pages.
Okay.
It'll fill up most of a disk. And then the Biodiversity Treaty is there, a treaty on climate control is there, and three others. I can't think offhand what the names of them are.
Okay, thank you so much.
Now, I have a question, though. Regarding the biosphere regions...
In the United States.
Yeah, or, well, anywhere for that matter. That's all outlined as well on UN websites. In detail, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Now, one thing I was trying to figure out was the connection between them, because there seems to be a delineation that says that these are going to be isolated regions. It seems the interstate highway system is going to be probably demolished. And
well, certain sections of it would be. In fact, there's a proposal right now to eliminate I-78, I guess, in southern Florida. But nonetheless, you're right, absolutely. In fact, the Man in the Biosphere Program, the 1975 U.S. Strategic Plan, is headquartered, by the way, out of the State Department, has right in it various linkage statements to both the World Heritage Convention as well as the Convention on Biological Diversity. In fact, it boldly says that the Man in the Biosphere Program has been revamped over the last several years, so that it is now the testing ground for the precepts and concepts of the Convention on Biological Diversity. And here we have those 47 million acres worth of Man in the Biosphere Program sites around the country that are now the testing ground, according to the strategic plan, for implementation of the Convention on Biological Diversity. And most people don't even know that they may be living right next door to one and are in this so-called buffer zone that will eventually result in extremely tight regulatory authority, non-elected authority. That's the other thing we haven't discussed, is that all of this, right from the very top down, or all the power resides in non-elected officials of one form or another.
Non-elected. As a part of the NGO structure.
Sure.
Primarily, it's controlled by NGOs.
Yeah.
In most of the documents that we have gotten a hold of, NGOs make up at least half of any governing council, or you name it, whatever it is, for a bioregion, whatever the fact is that they're trying to set up. An NGO, various NGOs account for up to half of that particular governing council. The rest of them might be businessmen or state officials or county officials or something like that, but it's dominated by NGOs. Now, if you don't know what an NGO is, a non-governmental organization, And most of them, at least the way it's defined and actually set up within the United Nations and what is known as the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, those are all environmental organizations, socialist organizations, or these New Age organizations. You will never find a property rights NGO sanctioned by the United Nations or by the IUCN that will be so involved in this.
This is Dr. Stan, and we're just back here for the last segment of our fascinating conversation with Dr. Michael Kaufman. His book, Saviors of the Earth, and his other book on the New Dark Age and the spiritual aspect of the struggle, at 1-800-799-9878. That's 1-800-799-9878. Is that 800 number working only during office hours, or is that a 24-hour answer?
No, it's primarily during office hours. We usually have it manned till about 8 o'clock or 8:30 or so Eastern time.
Okay, don't call now.
Yeah, right. You won't find anybody here.
Okay, fine. And the name of your second book?
It's called Saviors of the Earth, The Politics and Religion of Environmentalism. And we're talking primarily about environmental leadership here. And you, just before the break, had indicated, is there a spiritual dimension to this? And the answer, of course, is absolutely that is the heart of what the whole problem is it is a spiritual battle, first and foremost above anything else. The other manifestations, the globalist efforts, the power politics and trying to revoke property rights and all the rest stem from the fact that if Satan comes first, then he is going to do things that will totally try to pin down and to put into slavery and bondage the human race. And everything comes from the fact that we are truly in a spiritual warfare.
No question at all. You say it very well. And this is, of course, the message we try to get out time and time again here on our program, that the battle is spiritual, but it's being fought on the political, ecological, environmental battlefield.
Absolutely. And I go into quite great depth on that whole issue and Saviors of the Earth, because it's really important that people understand within the Christian church where this is coming from and why it could sound so right on the surface and be so deadly to their own spiritual welfare as well as to the health and freedoms that we have enjoyed over the last 200 years in this nation.